Hello and welcome to Books and Beer. I am your host, Michael Malone. I am virtually live from The Oath in scenic Tarrytown, New York. The Oath bills itself as a, quote, craft beer sanctuary, unquote. So if you love painstakingly crafted local craft brews, well, The Oath is your new man cave. And my guest today, all the way from New York City, Andrew Albanese. He is a senior writer and features editor at the book publishing Bible, Publishers Weekly. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hey there, Mike.
How was your ride up today?
Easy, piece of cake.
Have you been to Tarrytown before?
Yeah, I've been through Tarrytown a number of times before. I can't say I've spent much time here, and I can say that the addition of a pub like The Oath is pretty awesome.
It is a pretty cool place. And a day like this, you know, where it's 80-something degrees, climbing close to 90, you kind of get that feel for like a day when you want to duck into a dark pub, have a nice beer, let the AC do its thing, and kind of help you beat the heat. Huh?
And certainly some of the beers that are on tap here, there's quite a menu.
Yes, that is absolutely the truth. A quick perusal of the menu, boy oh boy. Well, first of all, we're going to do the Black Hog Swag, which is a summer wheat, and we're going to do the Rushing Duck Chained to the Dead. So something nice and light and sweet, and something dark and gory and foreboding. So both ends of the beer spectrum here. Looking down the list, there's also a Down East Cider Summer Blend out of Maine. There is Green Flash Styrian Golding Pale Ale from California. What else we got? New Belgium Citradelic Tangerine IPA, Colorado. So spanning both local and national, some really tasty beers here. So I want to talk about book publishing. And tell us about your day job. Did I get the title right? Senior writer?
Senior writer, correct.
Okay, what do you do at Publishers Weekly?
My job is mostly to do more long-form journalism. I cover the international scene. That means like I go to book fairs like Frankfurt and London. I follow translated books. And I do longer features about trends in the book publishing industry. Mm-hmm. And occasionally, well, more than occasionally, I do interviews with authors who have books coming out. Publishers Weekly is a trade-facing publication, so generally the reviews that we put out will be for books that are 4, sometimes 6 months before they actually come out.
Okay.
And that's so the trade can know what's coming out and actually get their orders in early. But we are increasingly a consumer-facing publication as well. We have over 600,000 followers on Twitter. We have products like Tipsheet that you can sign up for that will let you know what books are actually out right now that you should go and buy. Starred reviews. We have a radio show. We have another weekly podcast called The Week Ahead that I do with Christopher Keneally from the Copyright Clearance Center. So we're a trade-facing journal, but increasingly moving into the commercial space as well.
How influential is a starred review from Publishers Weekly?
Tremendously, and I'm not just saying this because I work for Publishers Weekly, but tremendously influential. Not only can it really make or break a book, it's about being discovered now.
Yeah.
Much like with a good craft beer, it's hard to know what's available, what's coming out, what is there. So PW is really sort of looked to for those in the industry to stand out amongst the growing sea of books and new content that's coming out.
Sure. What's the cost for a starred review? A couple hundred thousand or something?
Yeah, I'm tapping my nose here. I'm giving you the signal. Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned interviewing some authors. Any that stand out? Anybody that turned out to be a huge flake or a lot of fun to talk to or you know, certainly hugely famous person or anything like that?
You know, almost every author I've ever spoken to and have done an interview with has been tremendously fun. My favorite author, it's hard to say. I'm a fan of Nathaniel Philbricks. I don't know if you've read any of his stuff. He did a tremendous book about the Pilgrims not too long ago, and I had a great conversation, eye-opening two-hour lunch with him about that book. And he has a new book that's out now called Valiant Ambition, and it's about George Washington and Benedict Arnold. I'm a big fan of nonfiction, and Nathaniel Philbrick, who's won a National Book Award, he writes nonfiction like it's fiction. I mean, it just pulls you along every step of the way. You learn a lot. It's meticulously researched, and yet it reads like a novel. And this book about George Washington and Benedict Arnold is quite something. And
yeah.
It will really change your mind about what you think you know about both Washington and Benedict Arnold.
Now, Arnold was in a pretty tough spot, if I understand correctly. He wasn't getting a lot of respect as being a field general and was a little short of cash, so he was susceptible to being turned, I guess.
Huh? You're exactly right about that. Not a lot of people know that. There, you know, it doesn't excuse perhaps him turning traitor at the time, but the American Revolution was at a really perilous point at that point. It was Congress was not supporting the war. The American public had sort of lost interest in the war. And you're right, Arnold was sort of being, is for all of his great work on the battlefield, he was not being he was not being promoted and pushed up like he'd expected to be. There was a lot that was going on, but actually, ironically, it was the fact that Arnold turned traitor that may have won the revolution for the Americans, because it did sort of vault the Revolutionary War back into the public's mind and into Congress's mind. So as much as, and Phil Brick said this in an interview, which is up on the PW site now if you want to learn a little bit more, that as much as Washington's actions won the revolution, Arnold's contributed to winning the revolution as well from the other side as a traitor.
How did the media cover Arnold turning at the time? You may not have any idea, but I just, you know, as a media person, I'm fascinated. Like, was this a story that came out in the Times like 2 weeks after it happened? Or?
Such as it was, you know, there was obviously no internet at the time, and it took, you know, many months for you know, newspapers to reach the pubs where they were read. But Arnold was covered much the same way that, you know, Gawker might have covered it today, or the New York Post, with like extremely negative, biased headlines.
Okay.
He was his being labeled a traitor was every bit as rough as something that you might see on the internet today.
Which TV show from our childhood do you think of when you hear Benedict Arnold?
Oh boy. Do you have one in mind?
I do. It's
towards?
Something I think of. Maybe not everybody thinks this way, but one of the main characters did not want to play Benedict Arnold in the school play.
The Brady Bunch?
It was the
Brady
Bunch.
Well, we're really dating ourselves now, aren't
which,
we?
Which Brady?
Was it Peter?
It was Peter.
Because he said something Peter would do.
Well, after that correct answer, why don't we sample a beer here? What do you think?
Let's do it.
All right. Upon the recommendation of the good men who staffed this place, they said do the Black Hog first, because this is a much, much lighter one than that monster from Rushing Duck. So let me tell you about this one. It is Black Hog Brewing. It's out of Oxford, Connecticut. Brothers Jason and Tom Sobiesinski come from a Polish-Italian family where food and drink is always the focus of every gathering. From Jason's wedding to his son's birthdays, roasting a pig has become the favorite way to celebrate any special occasion. Tyler Jones, an old family friend and former brewer of the Portsmouth Brewery in New Hampshire, contacted Jason and Tom with a plan to move to New Haven so his wife and son could be closer to their family. With a plan in the works to form a brewery that would celebrate family and food, they needed to encompass all that they were passionate about. When they celebrate, they roast a hog, and the Berkshire pig is the breed of choice. Thus, Black Hog Brewing was born. Without further ado, okay, this is the Swag, S period W period A period G period. It's a 4.3% alcohol, so a nice summery, you know, noontime beer.
Cheers.
Take a sip, tell me what you think.
Wow. Wheat beer, yes?
Wheat beer, yep. Yes. So let me tell you a little bit more about it. A summer wheat ale brewed with grapefruit. The Swag is a refreshing American wheat ale with hints of citrus from fresh grapefruit peels. I'm probably taking all your descriptors away here. A light, herbaceous pop from herbs we grow in our brewery garden boxes. So a little vegetal, a little fruity.
I love the grapefruit, and I've been a big fan of grapefruit in beer. It's something we've seen a lot more of in the recent years.
Definitely.
But I haven't had a wheat beer with a grapefruit.
It's a good point. Something very common, obviously, in the IPAs, the double IPAs, those big hoppy beers. But here you get your grapefruit flavor. You get your vitamin C with a lighter beer.
I didn't think about the vitamin C, but that's a good point. And I also like that we're sipping this out of a Captain Lawrence glass. It's a brewery that I've become a bit of a fan
that's
of.
That's right. I hadn't noticed
local
that. Full disclosure due here. I pen the weekly notes from the tasting room story for Captain Lawrence.
Look at that. I wasn't even trying to shill you.
No. unpaid product placement here. But no, they are great guys. And you could argue that ones that really made this great Hudson Valley brewing scene what it is, kind of paved the way for some of the other guys. But a really flavorful beer despite a relatively low alcohol level for Black Hog's swag.
Something that I could certainly see myself pounding back a few of these on a nice hot day like today.
Very definitely. A well-suited beer for a steamy day. Quite a bit going on in Tarrytown. Looks like a movie shoot going on Main Street here.
Yeah, saw that.
Something called Wanderlust. I don't know what that is, but we'll look for that in a year's time or so. All right, so Publishers Weekly, if I understand correctly, they were part of a big media company and then got spun off and bought by some kind of book diehard type?
That's right. We were initially part of Reed Elsevier for a number of years, and before that, Connors Publishing. But, you know, the publishing industry has changed quite a bit since the dawn of the internet.
Yep.
Reed decided that the trade publishing direction was not something that they wanted to continue going in, so they sold the magazine off. They auctioned off a number of their magazines, and an old publisher of PW named George Slowick Jr., who was a publisher of Publishers Weekly in the 90s, popped out of nowhere pretty much and scooped it up. And since that time, he's really, like, under Reed Elsevier, I'm not shy to say it, Reed's corporate imperative was not really meshing with what we wanted to do at PW. Yep. They were sort of slowly choking us out of business, to be perfectly honest about it. And George immediately turned the magazine around, and we've been on a steady growth path ever since. We've grown significantly since 2010 when we became independent, and we've sort of reestablished ourselves. Not that we'd ever really lost the cachet in the brand, but we've ventured into new consumer territory. We've sort of grown the brand in new directions.
Yeah.
So it's a very exciting time to be a Publishers Weekly.
Yeah. Now, was this a business decision for George, or something that he just loved the brand and wanted to own it?
Well, I think it was a little bit of both. I think initially he really loved the brand. And I think that, you know, speaking out of school here a little bit,
that's what we do.
The end of his tenure at PW in the 90s didn't go quite as he had hoped.
Okay.
I don't know the full story behind it, but I gather he would like to have stayed on with Publishers Weekly a bit longer. There may have been a power play that pushed him out.
Yeah.
So coming back and working with PW, something that he always loved, I think was always something that he wanted to do. But obviously he wouldn't have done it if there wasn't a business that he saw there.
Sure.
And to George's credit, he immediately saw what the business opportunities were for PW. Interestingly enough, we had a town hall meeting on Monday of this week where he sort of gave us an update of where the business was, and he shared with us some of the predictions that he had made in 2010 versus where they are now. And we were pretty much up over every prediction that he had made, including with advertising. You know, we had our advertising that he thought would, in print at least, would tail off, has actually increased pretty dramatically.
Wow.
So he's done a terrific job leading us into the new century.
And the publication is still weekly?
It's still weekly, still in print. Our web presence has really grown considerably. We're now over 1 million unique visitors every month, which is terrific. So we view ourselves as web first, but we still do a weekly print magazine that has stayed pretty relatively stable, which,
that's great.
You know, yay print.
Yeah, something to be said for that. So in terms of the book world, what's new? What's kind of the big story? What's the trend? Say, how is the industry doing health-wise?
Well, I would say to me the biggest story within the industry that may just starting to be, you know, leaking out to consumers is ebooks.
Okay.
And frankly, you know, ebooks have been tanking. There was a period in which when the Kindle just came out and Apple was getting into the game, that ebooks were eating up a larger and larger share of the market. But in the last two years actually, ebook sales have actually begun to decline, and they actually closed out 2015 with sales down about 13% in the ebook market.
What's causing that?
It's a number of things. One of them, obviously, is price.
Yeah.
You may remember there was a lawsuit, an antitrust lawsuit against Apple over the switch to the agency model, which is the model under which ebooks were initially sold. Initially, ebooks were sold much like print books were sold, on a wholesale model. So you'd buy the print, you'd quote unquote buy the ebook edition from the publisher for a 50% discount, and then you'd sell it for whatever price you wanted to, and make whatever profit you could off of that 50%, you know, discount. of course, Amazon came into the game and they started selling books for $9.99, which was actually below the 50% discount threshold. So they were actually taking a loss on ebook sales in order to build up market share and to sell more of the Kindle.
Okay.
And publishers saw that as a threat to competition in the industry. So they switched the whole industry over with the help of Apple to the agency model. Under the agency model, publishers now take a 70% cut of every sale, and they give an agency cut, a 30% commission, to people who sell those books.
Okay.
And while that has stabilized the industry in terms of prices, publishers have taken the opportunity to sort of raise prices back up to what they think are more reasonable. The big problem that publishers had with the $9.99 price that Amazon was charging, in their minds, it devalued books.
Yeah.
How could they go on selling $25, $30 hardcovers if consumers were now used to paying $9.99 for a book?
Sure.
So their entire, what they really wanted to do from the beginning with the agency model was raise the prices of books, which landed them in trouble with the Department of Justice for price fixing.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have seen now is that now that they have control, now that this lawsuit is over and that pricing control rests with the publishers, they've raised the prices of ebooks back up to $14, $15.
Oh, wow.
And I think the consumer does not see the value in paying $15 for an ebook.
For something they can't physically hold.
Something they can't physically hold or pass on or resell or you know, balance out furniture, put it under the leg of a sofa.
The multi-uses of a book.
So I think price is probably the largest factor. And also, I'm just not sure that people see, I think there will always be a diehard number of people that prefer to read in print.
Yeah,
and I think we're starting to see that balance out a little bit. People love to read; they love to read on their phones. But is it worth paying an extra $15 to have a digital edition of a book when you can buy the paperback for $7 or $8?
Yeah, or used for $3.99.
Right, or go to the library.
Good point. What's your mode of reading? Are you an ebook reader or do you prefer print?
So I think I'm like most consumers today, I read on everything. Now, I will say because of the job that I have, I mostly read print. Mm-hmm. And that's because publishers are still so wary of piracy that they don't send me electronic versions of books that they want me to cover or to review.
Yeah.
So they send me print books all the time. And not like I, would be pirating books anyway.
Right.
But they're still pretty nervous about distributing things. So most of the books that I get come out in galley form about 6 months out of publication in print. And that's how I read most of them. When I buy a book, I'll often buy it digitally.
Yeah.
And I'll read it on my phone. So, interestingly enough, during this whole Apple ebook agency model antitrust suit, Steve Jobs, a lot of his emails were entered into the record. And one of the reasons why Steve Jobs never wanted to get into the ebook game up until the launch of the iPad was because he didn't think that there was a device out there that was good for a reading experience.
Yeah.
And it turns out he was wrong about that because people started reading on their iPhones well before the iPad came out.
Huh.
And now the iPhone is actually probably as much preferred as a reading device as the iPad is.
No kidding.
I don't think the iPad, he predicted that the iPad would spur this consumer ebook revolution.
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened. The iPad has not spurred an ebook revolution, and I don't think that that's really the optimal way to read books on the iPad. I think people buy iPads for a number of reasons, but not necessarily to read books.
Yeah.
Especially when it costs $15 to get an ebook. And you can watch unlimited Netflix for $9.99 a month. You can watch hundreds of hours of great videos for this, for less than it can to buy one book.
Right.
But people do like reading on their phones. You can carry them around in your pocket. The iPhone 6 has a bigger screen, so that's been a nice development. You can be in line at the store and pull out your ebook edition and start reading there. So I think that the growth that you're going to see is reading on mobile phones.
Yeah. My own case in point, I read almost everything in hard copy tactile form, but we had these horrible train delays last week, and had already read my Times over the course of an hour and a half delay, and pulled up my iPhone and had an Amazon Reader on there. It had some Chuck Klosterman things that I've been meaning to read for a long time, and read on my phone for the first time in a long time.
You can't underestimate the convenience of being able to read on your phone.
Well, that's the thing. Everybody's got the phone in their pocket. They're using it for most everything else in the world. So if they're going to read, that is a lot of where their reading is going to
be. But this now presents a problem for publishers because they've hit what we've sort of in the industry have sort of called the convenience plateau. And that's that, you know, that's all ebooks offer you is convenience.
Yeah.
You know, there's no other bells and whistles. Enhanced editions like, you know, director's cut books, etc., are something that haven't really done well and consumers haven't really showed an interest in. So once you've actually, you know, given everything you can give to an ebook edition, which is convenience, how do you make it better? How do you entice people to buy more of them or read more?
What about a search function? I mean, something where in an actual book, you've got to scroll through a bunch of pages and look for a certain word that you've got in mind.
Yeah, sure. And that is certainly part of the convenience function. And most every book does offer a search function. And there's all kinds of little tools and highlighting, etc. But that hasn't proven to be so much of an enticement to people. Now, preferably, I would love to be able to buy a bundle. And ebook bundling is something that's happening a lot now, where you can buy the print book and then you, for an extra $2, you get the ebook edition as well.
Okay.
Now, I personally think you should get the ebook edition for free when you buy the print book. And it would be great to be able to own the print book and read the print book. But if you want to search and remember that passage you're looking for, you can just pull out your phone.
Or you got a big, heavy book that you don't want to bring on the train.
Right. And it
read one at home, read the other one on the train.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think publishers have been looking to get two bites at the apple, ebook sales versus book sales. And I think over time it would be wise for them to look at bundling and not only, you know, offering ebooks cheaply for people who buy print, but just for giving it to them for free. Perfectly honest.
Now, something I just thought of, is there any kind of advertising model within an ebook? Is that something they're looking into or is that verboten?
It's funny to me that it's verboten among publishers. Most people don't want to talk about having advertising supported ebooks. The Kindle does do it. Amazon will sell you a Kindle edition that's really cheap that will include some sort of advertising in there. So you can buy a cheap edition of a Kindle that, you know, force feeds you sort of Amazon ads. And I have no problem with that. You know, advertising is so ubiquitous now, it's not hard to look over them or look past them.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, I'm a fan of English Premier League soccer and I look at the teams on the field and they've all got advertising on their jerseys.
Which was fought for a long time.
But if it makes the game better, it doesn't even bother me what's on the jersey. Though I will say, I would not like to see, you know, Chevrolet on a New York Yankee jersey anytime soon.
That is hard to picture.
That is hard to picture. But, you know, nevertheless, I think for publishers and for probably newer publishers that are getting into the game, that advertising is going to be a model that they're going to have to consider.
Yeah, sure. So you're an author in your own right. You've got an ebook out, right?
I do indeed.
What's the name of that one?
It's The Battle of $9.99. It's about the Apple ebooks price fixing case.
Okay.
It's available on Amazon. It actually did really well for a topic that I thought was pretty inside baseball.
Yeah.
Even though I'm pull my own, you know, praise myself here. It's pretty readable stuff.
Sure.
It actually hit number one on the Kindle list when it came out.
Oh, so, my gosh.
Yeah, on the Kindle singles list. It's
what a thrill that must have been. Huh?
It was. You know, I passed David Mamet, and I remember getting an email from my boss saying, hey,
you passed David.
David Mamet's looking up at you now at number one. And, and it stayed in the top 10 for a number of weeks and rested around number five for about 5 or 6 weeks. And it still continues to sell about, you know, 40, 50 copies a month.
So, wow.
Surprisingly, it's only $1.99. And if you're at all curious about what went down with the price fixing of ebooks, you can read this book in about 4 hours.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, obviously you were perfectly suited to write that and you're interested in it. But does that ultimately translate to some beer money for you or was that just kind of for fun?
Yeah, you know, I did make a little beer money on it and I continue to, you know, make a little bit extra and, you know, not much beer, but you know, I definitely do make some money on it. I think it's done more for me reputation-wise than it has in terms of actual money. But it was something that I was covering for PW. I had read all the court documents, and I really wrote the book because I wanted to understand the case better myself before the trial started. And so I pulled it all together from court documents, and when I was doing it, I noticed that there was a really compelling narrative there, one that included Steve Jobs, a lot of Steve Jobs' email, and Jobs was a famously private person. So to have those emails, thanks to a DOJ, you know, subpoena entered into evidence and available for me to read, made it worthwhile.
Emails he wrote, never expecting that they would be shared beyond the recipient.
Absolutely, yeah. His thoughts on, you know, what Apple was doing right or wrong in the ebook industry. What and most interesting to me was a correspondence that he had with James Murdoch of News Corp, sort of strong-arming him to get in onto the agency model switch.
No kidding.
And you know, he spoke very frankly in there. And one of the things that he said that I will look back on now fondly is that he thought Amazon might be right charging $9.99.
Really?
He was willing to give it a shot at a higher price, but anything higher than the levels that Apple was pushing for, which was $12.99 for the highest price, he was pretty sure the publishers were going to fail. Mm-hmm. And now that ebooks are priced at $14.99 and ebook sales are declining, Jobs was right about that. Anything higher than $12.99 was not going to work.
Okay, interesting. So I'm curious about, we get some aspiring authors and some first-time authors among our listeners here, but what's the state of advances for authors? Are some of them making some money, or is this just kind of a labor of love for most of the people out there?
You know, income inequality has hit big publishing too. Big publishing today is a hits-driven business. There was a time, not so long ago, in the publishing industry where publishers would pay good advances. And by good advances, I would say from $50,000 to $100,000 for what they would call a mid-list author. And that's somebody that sells about 20,000 copies.
That would be both fiction and nonfiction?
Both fiction and nonfiction. Okay. Though fiction obviously sells a little better than nonfiction in terms of numbers. But they would give you time to develop an audience. You know, they would give you four or five books. And as long as those books sold pretty well and your reviews were good, they'd keep signing you up. But now you've got to come out of the gate and you've got to sell a lot of copies right away. So advances for authors in that mid-list in the former 20,000 copy range are virtually disappearing.
Okay.
Those authors are now going to small independent publishers, and a lot of them are choosing to self-publish. And we can talk about self-publishing in a bit too. I'm a big booster of self-publishing. But where you are seeing larger advances is at the very top. You're seeing the return of $1 million advances.
The 1%.
You got it. But that's mostly for authors like the James Pattersons and the Stephen Kings, or new authors who have tremendous sales potentials, even though they don't always work out. There's been a couple of notable books that have been signed up for massive amounts that have not sold well. Probably the most prominent would be Garth Hallberg's book, City on Fire.
I started it. It's long. That would be a nice one to have in digital form.
A doorstopper of a book, yes. And Knopf reportedly paid, this is his first book. I think it's his first. I mean, he may have a lesser work that was written in a workshop or something. But this is his big debut major publishing novel. Sure. And Knopf paid $2.5 million for it.
Now, can they make their money back on that?
I don't see any way.
Is that a prestige play more than anything?
A little of both, I think. I think they see this book as a prestige play for them, but they certainly would want to make their money back on this.
Sure, sure.
And they, having an advance that large is a double-edged sword for somebody like Hallberg.
Pressure.
I don't know how you're liking the book so far. I've got a copy, too.
It won't be the next book I finish. I hate to say this, but I want a quicker payoff. And this one, I look at it, and you know, I went through this with A Brief History of Seven Killings last year, where it was a lot of work. It felt like work. The payoff was great, but it was 2 months of my life during which I could have knocked off three or four books of much lighter heft. So
agreed.
I will finish it. I think the portrait of 70s New York that he paints is wonderfully rendered. But it's as you say, it's a doorstop of a book.
And you know, the reviews have been okay. They haven't been bad. They've been pretty good for the most part. But it's just it's not striking me as the kind of commercial book that's going to earn back $2.5 million.
Yeah. He's a young guy, though. I think, you know, maybe it's an investment in him.
You know, I started to say about the double-edged sword there. I mean, unfortunately for Hallberg, who is a talented writer, he's now got this burden of having a 2.5. The story is pretty much his advance.
Yes.
And not his book.
And the schadenfreude that comes with that.
That's true. Absolutely. And I feel bad. I feel like it's a disadvantage. I feel like it's something for him that he has to ignore. Every interview has to start with the presumption that he's something other than who he is.
Yeah.
Because of the advance number that's been put on him.
Yep.
Not that any writer would ever turn down, or any agent would ever turn down a big payday like this. But it's unfortunate that the perception of his work is colored by a $2.5 million advance.
Sure, sure. Okay, well, speaking of colored and coloring, I want to talk about adult coloring books. I mean, this is a segment of the book world that is actually selling.
Incredibly so. And it's
does this mark the end of civilization, or am I reading this wrong?
You're not the first person to actually suggest that, but I don't think it is. I actually think it's a good thing.
Grown-ups are coloring.
Grown-ups are coloring, yeah. And I'll tell you why I think it's a good thing.
Have you done this before?
My wife has, actually. She's, okay. You know, I don't know that she's gone out and bought them, but she's been sent them for her job as well, and okay. I think she's actually, you know, enjoyed them. But I'll say this about adult coloring books. Print books have risen. Like, where ebooks have declined in the last 2 years, print books have been sort of roaring back to life.
Okay.
But one of the main reasons why is adult coloring books. They've jumped up sales in the trade paperback segment, under which they're classified, by, you know, as much as 15% to 20%.
Wow.
But the thing is, you know, they're bringing people in to independent bookstores. And while people are in those independent bookstores, they're browsing and they're buying other books as well. So while adult coloring books may seem like, you know, sort of the end of civilization.
It's just hard to say with a straight face.
It is hard to say adult coloring books.
I notice you smirk when you say it too.
Absolutely. But, you know, people are enjoying them, so I would never look down on what people are enjoying.
No.
And they're throwing a much needed lifeline to independent booksellers.
Okay.
Independent bookstores are bringing up a lot of these things. They're putting them in the window. They're bringing people into the store. And those people are walking out with more than just the coloring books.
Okay, well, that says something. How are they different from coloring books? Are they more like graphic novels? Like, what the heck are they?
Well, you know, they're not like Scooby-Doo and the kind of like coloring books that my daughter likes, or butterflies or princesses, or, you know, sports like my son likes.
Yeah, no Lightning McQueen here.
They're pretty intricate, a lot of them. Some of them are very adult coloring books, as in like profane.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. There's some really funny stuff. Like you might see a funny needlepoint, like sometimes. I don't know how at liberty I am to use off-color language on this podcast.
You know what? We are not FCC regulated, so speak your mind, son.
But yeah, there's been a number of, you know, fuck-off related coloring books that adults are finding charming. They make great gifts.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're just, you know, a little more intricate. I mean, my six-year-old daughter has a hard time coloring inside the lines.
Right.
Well, she would never come close to coloring inside the lines because of some of these books. But my wife has made some, they look like, you know, stained glass when she's done with them. And adults use everything from watercolors to charcoal to pencils to crayons. Like, there's all kinds of different ways that people are using them. Now, how many of these are being framed and hung up in people's houses, or if they're just being used as stress relief on the train?
Yeah.
I don't know. But they are doing an enormous business right now.
Huh. Interesting. Let's have a beer.
Let's do it.
All right, let's see what we're having next here. It is going to be, like we said, this thing's a monster. The manager is laughing at us because he knows we're about to dive into this thing. The Rushing Duck out of Chester, New York, the Chained to the Dead. It is, I looked up Chained to the Dead online, and a weird multi-influenced death metal band from Northern Jersey. So one of the guys at Rushing Duck is affiliated with the band. I guess he's part of the band. But anyway, as far as I can tell, this beer is done in conjunction with the band, the death metal band from Northern Jersey, Chained to the Dead. So this is an 11.2 alcohol by volume, probably the biggest beer you've ever had.
Well, some of the Belgians can get pretty high.
So. Yes. Okay, let's describe this thing here. Coffee tasting gore soaked delight. That's a phrase you don't see very often. Almost like adult coloring book. Gore soaked delight. For sure, thanks to a deadly collaboration between Rushing Duck and Chained to the Dead. Sweet cocoa sugaring and brown chocolate sweetness combine the light bourbon spicing for a relaxed, medium bodied dessert treat. Simply delicious and perfect for sweet tooth and fibers. Okay, they're calling it medium bodied. I just can't believe this would be anything less than full bodied, but let us find out for ourselves here.
Cheers.
Ooh, it's pucker up, huh? That is a big, bold,
wow.
Surprisingly smooth. You can taste the barrel aging there. I assume it's barrel aged. And I should remark on these adorable little goblets here. These round sampling glasses are just the cutest thing ever. Yeah, what do you got? What do you think? Too much?
Kind of love it.
Do you? Okay.
I'm going to take another gobble here.
Okay. Close your eyes and open up your mind and give me some free association as you sip the chained to the dead.
You know, it's very smooth.
Yeah.
And it finishes like a whiskey almost.
It does.
The notes.
Very definitely.
You can taste the coffee. It does a sweetness to it. After a meal, I could see myself really enjoying one of these. It almost has like the qualities of having a nice port at the end of
the meal.
Yeah,
I think you would always sleep well after a big meal in one of these.
But, you know, give me a nice steak dinner and this could be a great dessert for it as well.
Yeah.
The more I taste it, the more I really like it.
Does it feel like an 11% alcohol beer? Can you taste kind of the big alcohol presence?
Even though it does, it finishes like a liquor almost. No.
I would tend to agree with that, yeah.
It finishes like a piece of cake, actually. Mm-hmm. Like it's sort of a little velvety in my mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a wonderful beer. Rushing Duck, Chester, New York. You know where Chester is?
I'm going to guess it's north of here.
It is north of here. I asked you, but I don't really know. It's Putnam County or Dutchess. No, it's not Putnam. It's Dutchess or Orange, maybe. I've sampled their beers before. They had one called Lethargic Mallard, which was a funny little playoff.
What's the North Jersey metal connection then? If it's
they did it in conjunction with this band, Chained to the Dead. And I don't think Chained to the Dead refers to the Grateful Dead by any stretch here. Apparently, one of the guys from the brewery is in the band. Or is friends with the band or something like that, but they did it kind of as an homage to those death metal heroes chained to the dead, as far as I could tell.
Well, I think this is pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah.
And the more I drink it, the more I like it. Like, it's working for me.
Is it? Okay. Would this go with a little death metal soundtrack, do you think?
You know, I always figured death metal was more the Budweiser, you know, pound it down kind of scene.
Drink it out of a broken bottle?
This seems a little more sophisticated, you know? Not to say that death metal isn't sophisticated.
Like a Miles Davis kind of music, or what?
Yeah, you know, almost like something that I'd sit around and sip more than I would bang my head to.
Okay.
But who knows? I mean, give me another one and I might be banging my head.
So you're a musician, yep.
Well, you know, I think it'd be a stretch to call me a musician, but I'm in a band, yeah.
What's the name of the band?
The band used to be called Americans, and it's now, the new band is called School of English.
School of English?
Yes.
Where's that name come from?
A sign in Greenpoint, Brooklyn for a English school.
Okay.
And the sign said School of English, which I thought was not very good English for an English school.
You guys play out ever?
Not yet. We're starting to. We've been trying to record something for like the past 3 years, and it's coming along.
Okay.
Slowly. It's amazing how children sort of change the pace at which you pursue other artistic endeavors.
It is amazing, isn't it?
But, you know, we're going to get back at it next week and try to see if we can finish up a couple of songs and release them.
So. Fantastic. Very cool. And if it were to be Band X meets Band Y, what is the coupling of bands that produced your sound?
Buzzcocks, Joy Division, but a little sloppier, so like Guided by Voices meets Buzzcocks and Joy Division.
Now with that name, would people think that you guys are English? You're on tour?
You know, there's a bit of an English feel to the music that we've been writing now. The sort of a haunting Echo and the Bunnymen kind of guitar to it.
Okay.
But it's, yeah, I think that the name works because of that.
Yeah. So what are you reading now?
Right now, I'm finishing up two great books that came out this last year that I've been trying to finish because of children. I've had some hard times, but they're both nonfiction. Mm-hmm. One is a biography by Peter Guralnick of Sam Phillips, the Sun Records founder.
Sure.
And I've only got a very little bit left in this book, but the story is remarkable. I mean, you may think you know the story of Sun Records and of rock and roll in the South and Sam Phillips. Goralnik is a special talent,
yeah.
And he's created a panoramic that sort of captures all of the birth of rock and roll in America, actually.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the South, it's rock, it's beyond Elvis. It's an incredible book. And the other book that I'm really into is by Stacey Schiff, and it's called The Witches, and it's about the Salem Witch Trials in the 1600s.
Huh.
And it is also, I mean, made the mistake of picking up this book by accident while I was reading the Sam Phillips book, and I couldn't put it down.
Okay.
I had
all
to
right.
force myself to put it down. So Goralnik and Stacey Schiff as well are two of the finest nonfiction writers working in America today.
Now, is Goralnik mostly rock and roll bio stuff?
He's done a lot of that stuff in the past as well. He is a vaunted nonfiction writer. He's done mm-hmm. a couple of other topics outside the music industry, but he's, you know, certainly got his hands around. Sam Phillips actually was a personal friend of his. He knew him quite well. So there's a real... It doesn't come across in the nonfiction element, like there's a personal element to this as well. I don't
yeah.
know. I wouldn't say that he doesn't inject himself too much into, there's no, how would I put this? There's no sentimentality to his remembrance
right,
of Phillips.
There's not an emotional detachment either. Then.
But exactly, he knows the Phillips legacy intimately, and it shows in his writing and reporting.
Okay.
And Stacey Schiff, I believe, has won a Pulitzer or a National Book Award in the past. So, I mean, her talents are undeniable. And this book, you know, you think you know the story, like, again, like with Nathaniel Philbrick and Benedict Arnold and George Washington.
Right.
Stories that you kind of hear about growing up and you think they know the story, it's always so much more interesting when you get to know the real story.
Definitely, definitely. All right, I want to talk a little bit about self-publishing. You said before that segment's doing fairly well.
Yeah. It's growing by leaps and bounds. In fact, I think the latest stats that we had from 2015 were that self-published books are now about 15% of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's double from what it was in 2014. And I'm sure that number is even higher when it comes to ebooks. But the problem with ebooks is that the market is dominated by Amazon, who don't share their statistics.
Right.
So we don't know how deeply self-publishing is dominating, you know, the world of Amazon ebooks.
Okay.
But you can guess pretty deeply. You know, Amazon has an offering called Kindle Unlimited,
mm-hmm.
which is a subscription model. You can read $9.99 a month. You can dip in to over a million titles, the vast majority of which are from self-published authors.
Okay.
It's kind of a con job, I have to say. The way
How so?
Well, Amazon sets it up where they pay people whose books are read in Kindle Unlimited by a secret formula that only they know, and it's fractions of a penny per page.
Okay.
And that system is being gamed a little bit by some people, I think, who are, you know, writing books that are page turners and you know, they're getting paid higher amounts for that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there's no transparency. Like with a book and a copy, the way you sold it, you got a royalty for each copy that was sold. Amazon is in complete control over how these funds are being distributed each month. There's a pot of money they set aside to be paid to authors, and however many pages are read, it's divided amongst them. So I think right now that the rate is about 0.004 cents per page,
okay,
which is virtually nothing. So I mean, frankly, I without the transparency, it's hard to know, but I don't think it's a very good model for authors at this point.
Now, having the book market flooded with self-published works, and full disclosure, I've gone down that route. I've done three books with CreateSpace. But is that ultimately good for book publishing? I mean, you've got a lot of really kind of crummy books out there now.
Yeah, well, I think it's good. I think for book publishing, it's not viewed as terribly good. I think that they like to view themselves as the gatekeepers to
okay.
good literature.
Sure, sure.
But you can't convince me that, you know, the same way it was with independent labels in music and that stuff, you can't convince me that giving more people the tools by which to create and distribute their works is a bad thing for art or for literature
sure.
or for music. To me, the more voices that are heard, the better. Now, it certainly creates a problem of discovery. If I'm looking at this objectively, I'm not having a hard time finding good things to read.
Right.
I'm having trouble with finding enough time to read all the things that I want to read.
Sure.
And an increasing number of those books are coming from very small micro-publishers and self-published authors. The big problem I think self-publishing faces right now is that it still hasn't escaped its past. You know, where people view self-publishing as vanity publishing. Mm-hmm. You had these vanity presses that used to prey on authors and sell them back garage loads of books, and companies like Author Solutions that were sued recently for the allegations were that it was essentially preying off authors by upselling them worthless services. These are things that the industry, the self-publishing industry, is yet to move beyond. But it's undeniable that the quality of books being self-published today is getting better and better and better. And as the publishing industry, the major publishing industry, walks away from supporting the mid-list, those authors who you would have found at a bookstore 20 years ago are now finding that it's better for them to self-publish.
Sure, sure. You drew a neat analogy when we last spoke in this forum with independent publishing and independent brewing, where you get all these craft breweries popping up because the traditional gatekeepers no longer call all the shots, and it's given rise to some great beer and some not so great beer, but ultimately the quality stuff.
But you know what it's really enabled in both is experimentation, right?
Sure,
and
sure.
I had a conversation with Dave, the bartender here, before we started the interview. And it was fascinating. We the only thing we could think was that the internet played a role in both. Because before, you had to have a major distributor to get your beer found. So that meant you were going to be Schmitz or Budweiser or something, because the distributor has to sell beer that he can sell en masse to make money.
Yeah.
But now with the internet, you've got these communities that are growing up around beers. There's a way for independent brewers, small brewers, microbrewers, to actually, you know, get their beer out to people. And then beer goes viral just like a book can go viral,
yep,
right?
Absolutely.
Some people, a beer tasting group gets together and likes a certain beer. The next thing you know, it becomes very hot. And
yep. Any idea how many books the average self-publishing author sells?
No, and I wish I could. And if I could see the stats from Amazon, we would have a better idea.
Okay, yeah, hard to say if they're not sharing their numbers, huh?
But I'll say this, it's not enough to support them. But
right.
Then again, it's a very, very infinitesimally small number of authors that support themselves through writing alone.
Sure.
A great many authors who are even bestsellers also work second jobs or are professors,
yep,
or have writing appointments, or so they teach writing or something. It's really a very small number that do. And what I think this does is it makes you keep writing. You know, if you can't, J.D. Salinger is a perfect example. This guy wrote one great book, right? You know, and he never had to write again. That book took care of him for the rest of his life. That's not really an incentive to create if you can continually like earn money forever through a closed system.
Yeah.
If you're at the top of this closed system of publishing and you're the book that's in every bookstore window, you know, maybe he would have written more if he had to. Maybe if he had actually been forced to make a living, he would have, you know, written a little bit more and published a little bit more.
Nice problem to have, though.
It is, indeed.
All right, we're going to do the speed round.
Let's do it.
You up for it?
I'm going to take another sip of beer.
I don't know if that's good for your speed here, but it's up to you. All righty. The one beer I would take to a desert island for eternity.
Wow. You know, we've had this question before in the last speed round.
I think we did, yeah. I tend to repeat myself.
And it tends to keep changing for me. So right now, the beer that I'm really interested in, and I don't know why it took me so long to discover it, is Sweet Action from Six Point.
Okay.
To me, it's just an incredibly drinkable beer, and I confess I've drank too many of them on occasion.
Okay. The one book I would take to a desert island for eternity.
The one book I would take to a desert island for eternity. That is a very difficult question, but I'm going to skip that one. I'll come back to that one.
All right.
I've got like 10 different books that are
all right. We'll see if something pops into your memory in a bit. Okay. The author I would pick to have a beer with.
Well, he's not really an author, but Keith Richards, because his autobiography, which I also just finally got around to, has really been pretty incredible. But William Vollman. Probably
okay.
Would be like the person I would most really want to sit down with over a beer and talk about.
Good one, good one.
Books with.
Book everyone else loves that I did not get.
Again, at the risk of repeating myself from our speed round a year ago, it would be J.D. Salinger, A Catcher in the Rye.
Okay, wow. Tackling some canonical works here.
I've found that book to be really sort of vastly overrated.
Okay.
I find Holden Caulfield to be mentally ill and not necessarily reflective of this ennui that people seem to ascribe to him. So many people relate to the problems of a prep school kid in New York City.
Right.
And I just never did.
Okay. All right. Best New York City pub to enjoy a book and a beer.
It's hard to be speedy.
I know, it is. It's unfair, isn't it?
And I'll say this, that there's been, I can almost compare the plight of pubs in New York City to publishing these days, because it's so hard to be a good pub in New York City with rising real estate rents. It's difficult to find a pub in New York City that you can't sit down and read a book in these days.
True.
Just like it's difficult to find a major publisher out there. But I will say that I found one where my music studio is in East Williamsburg. It's Waterbury Street and Meserol. Right off the Montrose L stop. It's called The Well, and there's another one called The Anchor Inn, which is just around the corner from there.
Okay.
And they are tremendous in the number of beers that they have on tap. They are dedicated to craft beer, and they're never crowded, and you can pull up in a booth. And I often do for a good hour at a time before I'll go into the rehearsal room and just try a new beer and sit there and read something that somebody has sent me. It publishes
weekly.
Sounds
good. Wow. Hey, back to that earlier one. The one book I would take to a desert island for eternity. No eluding it this time.
You know, it would have to be something by Mark Twain.
Okay.
And I don't know which one that would be. It would probably be Huck Finn. But to me, those books, are, maybe it would be a Hemingway or something, but to me, Mark Twain was the quintessential American writer. And every time, and I was just starting to reread these books again, because they're fun to read to your kids, too.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I read Mark Twain, I just can't find a more American voice than his.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're on the desert island, you want something that just plays well over and over.
They just keep, you know, every time you read them, they hit a new note.
Yeah. So. Well, we're wrapping things up here, but a big thank you to Andrew Albanese from Publishers Weekly for making the trip to Tarrytown.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for introducing me to this remarkable pub.
The Oath. What a great little place this is, huh?
Tremendous. And I will say, I was talking with the bartender here, and I didn't know this, but they rotate the beers out, and once they're gone, they never come back.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yes.
Wow.
So if you want to try any of these beers that we've tried today at The Oath, get down here before the kegs run out.
Hop the train.
And it's
probably today.
Really great thing, because you know whenever you come in here, even though you might not be able to get a beer that you've liked here before, you're going to find something amazing here.
Yeah.
They're all about beer discovery here.
Yeah, and it's nice to have staff that really know what they're talking about.
And the food is great.
As well. Yeah, and it's train accessible from Grand Central, right?
Close walk. It's only about 5-minute walk from the train once you get here.
All right. Well, again, huge thank you to Andrew, and thank you for listening. We'll be back in a month or so with more books, more beer, and more books and beer. Cheers.